We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short, and this is ACAM Learn.
Welcome to Inside the Teen Brain. This ACAM series will leave you inspired by best practice and armed with tips to transform your work. I'm Dr. Jane Gilmore, and I have a special interest in the teenage brain. From puberty to about the age of 25, the brain is in a unique state, with core drives including identity, novelty, risk, peers, respect, autonomy, and intense emotions. In discussion with leading CAMS professionals, each episode will explore these developmental drives, and during our conversation, we answer three big questions. What's the background? So what? And now what? Today, we look inside the teen brain and explore digital technology. This episode is called Screen Agers. Let's go to our first big question. What does the literature tell us? All of us need connection to thrive, but the adolescent need for it is greater. We know too that they're drawn to risk and novelty. The internet serves up all these and in abundance. Orban's superb review considers the potential potency of digital experiences for young people. For example, it offers a social inclusion metric, public to peers, calibrated by the number of likes on a post. But enrichment opportunities live in the same space as the potential for harm. Highly sensitive content algorithms could offer a supportive, custom-made community or skew identity formation. We record this episode in a week where news headlines include phone bans and stark warnings of technoference in child development. But the neutral or positive links with social media use don't typically make mainstream narratives where negative attention biases thrive. For example, loneliness is particularly pernicious to the adolescent brain, and data show social networks can buffer feelings of isolation. All the benefits of face-to-face friendships exist online too, according to Yao and Rice review. Digital fun still counts as fun. Further, the protective role of digital social connection is illustrated by Metherol. During the pandemic, young people without access had disproportionately poorer mental health, but improved when their access was restored. Many studies ask if the rise in reported adolescent mental health conditions and screen time are related. However, despite a plethora of data, albeit with significant methodological challenges, there are few convincing causal patterns. It brings to mind the experience of our old friend Winnie the Pooh, who complained, "The more he looked, the more he couldn't find it." Typically, the direction of the effect is unclear, or there are conflicting results. In instances where a link between screen time and poorer mental health has emerged, the explanatory power is very small, much smaller than poverty or bullying, for example. There are perhaps stronger data showing that excessive screen use, and more specifically the time lost to it, rather than the content itself, may be problematic. For instance, if you're scrolling, you're neither exercising nor sleeping, both of which are enriching and protective. Shabilsky and Weinstein's paper somewhat resolves the tension between harm and benefit. For young people in the community, they describe the digital Goldilocks principle. Moderate use is beneficial, but excessive use or complete abstention are linked to poorer outcomes. Future policy must consider the nuance in different populations and their experiences of digital content. Emerging literature explores both individual and intra-individual experiences. Gender and age effects have been reviewed in the past, but future investigations may involve culture, personality type, pre-existing mental health, and solitary versus shared consumption. So, how can we sum up the literature status? It's complicated. Now we turn to our second question and ask, so what? We could get lost in this literature, so we're very lucky to have an expert guide to help us navigate it. Pete Etchells is Professor of Psychology and Science Communication at Bath Spa University, with a special interest in the effects of digital technology. As author of the award-winning book Unlocked: The Real Science of Screen Time and Lost in a Good Game, in addition to numerous publications in The New Scientist, Guardian, Observer, New York, Times, Telegraph and more, Pete brings balance and nuance into the mainstream and academic discussion about teens and tech. So welcome, Peter. We have a lot to cover.
Thank you for having me.
We are so grateful because you are sitting atop so much data and evidence. So I want to really crack through a variety of questions. We may not cover everything, but let's start, shall we?
Yeah, let's go for it. We can try our best.
That's all we can do. So your book Unlocked is an invaluable overview of the literature, and in it you write very generously about your own mental health and your thoughts of the contribution or not that screen use made to it. So what's the evidence that digital technology causes mental health disorders?
Oh, that's a question, isn't it? It's a very emotive question as well, because I think everybody's got their own opinions on this, and they are in many ways informed opinions because we all have experience of using digital tech. We all are very aware of our mental health. And we see, because we talk about this in the news and in our day-to-day lives so much, I think it's a very salient thing, right? We're very much aware of what's going on around us in terms of people on their phones, kids on their phones, people in cafes on tablets and things like that. So it's really, it's a really tricky one to go, okay, well, here's what the evidence says, here's what the science says, because very often, And the long and short of it is the science says it's very unhelpfully that it's complicated, right? That you have some studies which show negative effects, some studies which show positive effects, a lot of studies which don't really show anything. And that's not very helpful for people when you hold that up to what we literally see in front of our eyes. It's very difficult to go, well, why bother with the evidence then? But I think in many ways that's the reason why it's really important to interrogate the evidence. We've got to be really careful in this space that what we see in front of us is not necessarily representative of what happens to everybody and what happens to people in different situations to our own. And that actually this is where the power of evidence and scientific research comes to the fore, in that if we can look at this in a much broader way, then we do get to that deeper understanding, hopefully, I say. Mm. The problem there is that I think digital technology research is not in a great way at the minute. It's always been a difficult area to do research in. Fundamentally, what we're talking about here is something that people use in a very automatic way a lot of their day. And it's something that's not easily defined. So we talk about screen time a lot. We used to. I don't think we talk about screen time as much now, but I have seen it come back into the discussions recently. And we talk about screen time because it's an easy thing to get our heads around. It's an easy thing to measure. So scientists like this, because of that, you can ask people, how much time have you spent on your phone, or how much time have you spent on social media, or how much time have you spent playing video games in the past week or month or whatever you're interested in, and you get a number out of it.
Well, I think it's interesting though that recollection is distinctly low tech in a high tech question, isn't it? The recollection of how much time have I spent on my screen. But I interrupted. Keep going, because this is the nugget of where we're.
But it's a great point though, because the reason that we ask those questions is because they're easy and they seem straightforward, and it seems as though it gives you a very easily digestible answer. You literally get a number. And because we've not got much else to go off. So one of the things that I talk about in the book is the problem with that sort of self-report data. You know, I can ask you, how much time did you spend on Instagram last Tuesday? And you can give me a number. Whether that number is has any bearing on reality or not is a completely different question. And actually, there are some lines of research which show this, that it doesn't really, that we're pretty bad at these sorts of self-report measures, but we're stuck because that's the only kind of data that we can get a hold of. There is a vast treasure trove of really useful data here, even in that very simplistic term around how much time is somebody spending on a particular platform, that's held by the big tech companies, that's held by the platforms, that it is currently very difficult to get hold of, if not impossible to get hold of as a researcher. So we're really stuck at the minute. And this is why the research is one of the reasons why the research literature as a whole is pretty shaky, is that we're stuck because we keep having to rely on asking people essentially for their perceptions of how much time they spend on a particular platform. And that's not very useful for a variety of reasons. So that's I'd say the big problem. The conversation has shifted obviously over the past year or so. We're not really talking about screen time anymore. We're talking about smartphone use and social media use. But I'd say a lot of the issues that I talk about in the book around screen time are directly applicable to talking about social media. Social media as a concept is very vague, right? It's the obvious things like Instagram and TikTok and X and WhatsApp and things like that. But it's more esoteric things. It's things like Discord. Maybe it's also things like Google Classroom. I would argue under a lot of definitions that you see of social media, things like text messaging come under that, really in terms of strict definitions. And this might sound like a really nerdy thing to say, a really kind of almost boring deflection in a way. But it's actually really important. It's really important for the research literature. It's important for thinking about how we regulate the space as well. I'll give you two examples of why I think that's important, very practical ones.
Yeah.
Australia has enacted a law which is going to see social media banned for under 16-year-olds that's going to come into effect in December this year. That happened very quickly. That legislation happened in a very fast window of time, shockingly fast in many ways. I know it had been brewing for a while, but when things actually started off, we were talking about weeks, basically. And there was very little consultation from stakeholder groups and academics and youth participation groups and things like that. And part and parcel of that problem was that there weren't any clear definitions at one point of what they meant by social media. And at one point, I remember seeing a news story about how Snapchat were basically saying, well, we're exempt from this law because we're a messenger service. We're not a social media platform. Now, that's ludicrous, right? Of course, Snapchat's social media. And of course, Snapchat is the type of platform that you would presumably want to be targeting with a ban like that. But that's why the definition is important, because you don't want to regulate the wrong things, as it were. And then there's another example of, and we'll maybe talk a bit more about this in a bit around unintended consequences of getting the definitions wrong. This is a slightly different thing. This is not about teen mental health or well-being issues or anything like that. But in the US, there were moves to ban TikTok recently. So the publisher of TikTok, a company called ByteDance, took a preemptive move. And on, I think it was the 19th of January, so Sunday, the 19th of January, it was a Sunday, they switched TikTok off in the US. Now, I think that was a bit of a PR stunt, because they switched it on about 20 hours later, because the new president was going to come in and sort everything for them. Nevertheless, it effectively gets banned, right, for a short period of time in the US. What is relatively less known is that ByteDance are also the publisher of a really popular mobile video game called Marvel Snap, which is like a Marvel-based card game, collectible card game type thing. When ByteDance switched off TikTok, because it was due to a law around apps with kind of foreign investors and foreign developers needing to be banned, and the term there was app, not social media platform, ByteDance switched off everything that they have in the US, and that includes Marvel Snap. And nobody realized it. So nobody saw this coming. The actual developers of Marvel Snap didn't realize this was going to happen. So they were taken by surprise. And it
it's
took
the
a few...
evils of screen time, except for that screen time, except for the ones that are... yeah.
So it took a few days for the game to come back. And I think it's back now, but there are still a few problems with it. And the developers are looking for a new publisher to make sure this doesn't happen again. But that's the territory we're in with this lack of understanding of what it is that we're worried about and specifically what we need to regulate or understand in terms of the research. Those are regulation examples, but you basically see the same thing in the research literature, right? That the part of the reason why you see a bunch of studies that show positive effects of pick your screen time and a bunch of studies that show negative effects and a whole bunch of studies in the middle that don't really show anything is that everybody's measuring different things, but we're calling it screen time as a whole or social media as a whole. And actually that's also true on the other side of the coin. If you're interested in mental health, mental well-being, well, that's depression, anxiety, self-esteem, body image disorder, schizophrenia. Those are just top few things that I could think of research papers that I've looked at recently on screen time effects, but it's also positive things as well, like hedonic or eudaimonic well-being. They are all considered under the general banner of mental well-being. So when you start asking questions like, what does the research say about the effects of screen time on mental health, you kind of realize very quickly it's a bit of a meaningless question to ask. B, we're not doing a good job of it research-wise. And see, we're probably missing the actual questions we should be asking if we want to understand what's going on.
How would you interrogate the data if you could? What questions would you ask of it?
So we've got some lines of evidence in the literature to suggest that, digital tech impacts people's mental health. I don't think that's a controversial or shocking or interesting thing to say because most stuff does. So there are associations there, they're very small. What that says to me is that if you're trying to engage in a process where, you look at broad level population data and you go, okay, something happened in 2012 or 2010 or 2015. And if you look at these measures of teenage mental health, things look as though they started to get worse. And you've got an inflection point somewhere around the early 2010s. What caused that? What one big thing caused that? I think that's the wrong way of thinking about it. Because what you end up doing is getting into a situation where somebody goes, well, it's the phones and here's the research that supports that. And then somebody comes along and says, no, it's not, because this is why that research is naff. Maybe it's the global financial crisis. And somebody else comes along and says, well, it's not that because of this. And you end up with this like laundry list of things that might impact teenage mental health. You kind of go through it one by one and say, is it this? Maybe, but probably not that. And you kind of leave digital tech till the end and go, well, everything else we've accounted for, it must be digital tech because it's so ubiquitous. That's the debate that we're in, the public debate at the minute. And I think it's just the wrong way of thinking.
And I guess that there is also a danger that the capacity to switch off or dichotomously erase a mobile phone in a young person's hand is tempting as an intervention, whereas it's much more likely to be complex, a variety of variables interacting, an individual, experiences of the same content will be different, and so on and so on. And I think you raise a really interesting question about the ideas of definition and banning. This is not to say that legislation should and could be applied, but there's also something very tempting about the forbidden fruit, if you like, of content, and that it is so available in our society, but perhaps not to a particular age group, suggests that there will be immediate temptations, if you like, towards exploring unlegislated content because it's outside the legislation. So there's so much there. We are really, as my granny would say, in quite a muddle. I think there's a lot to do. I'm going to move on to another question, though, because I want to hear your thoughts on this idea. So we moved to the sort of content of the smartphone particularly, and the attention grabbing nature of a smartphone means that we now have a cohort of young people with poor attention spans. Discuss. What are your views?
It's another one, isn't it? It's the one that comes up a lot, and particularly, you know, obviously, certainly in the UK, but I think in quite a few countries at the minute, that this is particularly focused around the context of smartphone bans in schools. You know, teachers are feeling and reporting that, you know, kids are very distracted in class. Phones are the cause of that. But it's also causing all sorts of other problems in the playground and beyond. And this is that's one bit of a perhaps a wider concern that we all have at the minute, that we all feel this. I think we all feel pulled six ways from center, that it's really hard sometimes, a lot of the time, to concentrate on stuff. And it's really easy to be distracted by something else, your phone, is the obvious thing, and that has morphed over the past decade into this specific concern that it's actually because of digital technology that our attention spans are eroding. I don't think that is actually what's happening. So I've not seen any clear signals in the research literature to suggest that, you know, quantitatively, our attention spans are declining in a systematic way. We've just not seen that. I'll caveat that by saying there's not that much research to look into this. And I think there's some really kind of cool studies actually that you could do straight off the bat, where you look at, you know, if you take a particular type of attentional task in cognitive psychology and look at all the papers that have been published over the 10, 15 years, the past 10, 15 years, to see, you know, whether people's attentional abilities in their tasks are declining over time, that would give you a fairly good signal. And as far as I can tell, nobody's really done that. I think there's a couple of studies where they've not really found that much. I think, you know, and I've seen claims along the lines of, you know, smartphones are sort of taking 20% of our collective brain power. If that was true, society would not be functioning. You know, that is a tremendous statement to make without any clear evidence. And I think we probably wouldn't be having this conversation if that was true. It would be so obvious. I think the problem, and this kind of goes back to that definition thing that we were talking earlier around how you measure this sort of stuff. The problem is that it feels that way.
Mm-hmm.
So why does it feel that way? Well, I think there are multiple reasons for that. So one is, we are told that this is happening constantly. So we've been told for the past 10 years that our attention spans are now shorter than that of a goldfish, right? It's a sort of very common trope that people talk about, and you see variations on it. So my favorite one was a news story a few years ago where the National Basketball Association in the US, the NBA, was considering reducing the length of time of basketball games because millennials have an attention span shorter than a goldfish, right? Which is all complete nonsense. But it's a zombie statistic. You know, multiple people, including myself, have tried to figure out where that statistic comes from. It doesn't come from science. It seems to come from a marketing company around 10 years ago. And they've published data on, quote unquote, data on that every year. Even if it were the case that our attention spans were like 8 seconds now, I should say, and goldfish are like 9 seconds or something like that. That's not true. Goldfish don't have a short attention span like that. It doesn't seem to be declining. So everything about that statement is wrong, but it's a very easy one to kind of latch on to. And if you yourself are feeling distracted in your day-to-day life, then this is your worldview gets built up that this is something that's happening to you. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I'll say very quickly, that why I think this is happening and why it feels, you know, it certainly is the case when you're working on something and you're stressed and your phone pings off, you'll go and look at your phone and then you'll go and look at something else on your phone. And the next thing you know, you've wasted half an hour when you didn't want to. And I think it's that people worry about. And it's that sort of attention grabbing nature that we really worry about. Part of the reason that I think that happens is because, you know, these forms of tech, like our phones and things like that, are vastly useful machines, but they never really came with a training manual, right? You know, we pick up a phone, we buy a phone, first time we get a smartphone, nobody really tells you how to use it or how that use can go wrong or how to use it in an efficient or an effective way. You just kind of figure it out. You know, nobody really had a reason to download their first social media platform in 2010 or wherever. We just kind of did it because that's what everybody else was doing. And we figure out how to use it along the way. Mm-hmm. Some people do that really well and thrive. Other people don't do that very well and struggle. And for some people, yeah, you get really horrific outcomes from that. So this kind of goes back to that question we were talking about earlier, which is, you know, when you're asking questions like, what is the impact of digital technology on X, whether that's mental health or attention or whatever you worry about, I think that's the wrong question, because the answer will always be, it will have some effect, maybe not much, but that effect depends on other factors and other contexts. Mm. So I think the better question in all of these scenarios is the why question. Why is it that some people really thrive online and really get on well with using digital tech? You know, they're able to have a phone in front of them and not get distracted when they're doing work. They don't demonstrate problematic behaviors, all of those sorts of things. And why is it that in seemingly similar cases, other people really struggle? And I think that's true of adults as well as children and young people.
And even consume the same content in different ways.
Yeah.
So the same content delivered in the same platform at the same time of day will be considered and, you know, consumed in different ways, or even those intra-individual differences. So the same person mm-hmm. on a different day will experience yeah. it. And so these are the questions of the literature. You know, we are somewhat, and partly because of the problems with producing high quality literature, we are so far behind the contemporary experience of young people, and our data follows sadly behind, but there's so much to do. Which I want to sort of turn specifically to young people, because of course our series thinks particularly about adolescents. Now, we know the teenage brain orientates towards novelty and peers. So I always say to families, you know, a phone stands for friends and trends. So we might hypothesize that it's particularly attractive to teens. Is there any evidence for this, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. I think it would be silly to say that, you know, there are no effects here and that there's nothing to worry about. I don't think anybody is saying that. I think what we're trying to figure out at the minute is for what groups of adolescents and young people, in what situations and what contexts are there perhaps periods where they're maybe more sensitive to either a particular form of digital tech or moving on to social media and things like that. So there are some studies. There's a big study that came out probably 2-3 years ago now, probably about 2022. It was led by Amy Auburn at Cambridge University that tried to look at this. So taking like really big sets of data from literally like, I think it was like nearly 100,000 participants. That was across the lifespan. So from the age of about 10 to about 80 years old, and looking at, so basically self-reported social media use and very simply things like life satisfaction ratings. And what you see is that over the course of the lifespan, you see peaks and troughs in that. So you see places where social media seems to be really strongly associated with changes in life satisfaction, and then other periods where it's not. And when you look at teenagers in particular, there do seem to be these windows of sensitivity where there's negative relationships between, so increased social media use and decreased life satisfaction. Now, where that gets a little bit complicated is that you see, you know, in terms of what's affecting what, you kind of see it in both directions in a way. So you see some cases where you know, you take a measure of social media use at say age 14, I can't remember the specific ages, but like one age that seems to predict later changes in life satisfaction. It predicts a decrease in life satisfaction about a year later, but you see the opposite as well. So you see cases where teenagers reporting decreases in life satisfaction, that predicts later increases in social media use. Mm. And you see slight variations depending on where that specific window is, depending on whether you're looking at males versus females as well, and obviously across different ages. Now, I think that goes back to the idea we were talking about before in terms of maybe it's the question is not so much what predicts what or what causes what, but why do we see this? What's going on here? And one of the ways that I try to think about this is that it's impossible to take a phone or take social media as though it's like a black box unit in somebody's life and remove it and see what the impact of that is, really. The answer is it will have an impact on people's mental health, on children's mental health, positively and negatively. But it sits within an ecosystem of other factors that all interact with each other to then ultimately have an impact on mental health, good or bad. So there's some research, for example, that shows that you can predict the types of negative experiences that different groups of children will experience if you know what their pre-existing vulnerabilities are. Mm-hmm. Again, I talk about this a lot in the book. This is work by Adrian Katz and Ayman El-Assam at Kingston University. If you look at children with caring responsibilities as a sort of an in-depth example, they're more likely to be victims of cyber scams and online identity theft and things like that. Why is that the case? So it's not just whether they have a phone or not, or whether they have access to social media or not, it's other things. So if you look holistically at what's going on in those sorts of situations, so children who've got caring responsibilities, they're at home more than their peers because they've got those caring responsibilities. Mm. That means that they have more opportunity to be online for greater parts of the day, perhaps in an unsupervised way. They might also be dealing with their own physical and mental health vulnerabilities as well. And they also are more likely to be in situations where a sort of educational scaffolding around how to stay safe online is not there for them. Mm-hmm. You know, they might miss days at school where it's in safer internet day, so they don't get that training. They maybe don't have conversations at home around what they're doing online because of the relationships that they have and those responsibilities that they have. And all of those sorts of things together, you put them all together and that increases the likelihood that they'll get an email saying, click this link and you'll win £100,000. They'll click on it. And, yeah.
So the digital forum, it's where it plays out, but it's not really the problem, as it were. So the problem is the lack of scaffolding, the lack of, you know, perhaps being in charge of family finances, you know, lack of supervision and so on and so on. That's the problem, not the screen, as it were.
Yeah.
And the question is, you know, does it distract us from thinking about how to address the why? And I think, you know, you're describing that so eloquently. You know, this is such complicated data and it has such enormous repercussions, but, you know, it mustn't distract us from, you know, the explanatory variables are actually, to some degree, much more important and have further repercussions for our, you know, life trajectories and so on. It's a really nicely described example. I think that's fantastic. I wondered if we could think about, you know, sort of thinking about these vulnerable young people that you describe, for example, carers. You know, we do know that for some of these vulnerable young people, there could be risks. You know, for many young people in the community, as you say, they thrive or there are neutral effects. But for vulnerable young populations, the crucible of the digital forum can be, you know, pretty powerful. So how do we address, this is an impossible question, Pete, but how can we support these populations? Because often they're outside clinical practice or they're outside support services, and yet they are the ones that perhaps are most vulnerable, or at least their vulnerabilities will play out in the digital forum. So what can we do to support them?
It's a fantastic question, that, and it's obviously a really important and timely one. I think, you know, we're not doing as much as we could there. I honestly don't have a magic fix. I don't think there is one. I think in terms of where we need to start, though, is in really taking the heat out of the conversation, the conversations that we're having at the minute. So, you know, literally globally, we're having conversations around banning social media for under 16 year olds or under, pick your age, banning phones in schools, banning children from having smartphones. And you look at different countries and you see different different rules and laws in place. You know, I think it's France, there are proposals that I think, I can't remember the quite the ages, but I think it's children under the age of 11, no phones at all. Children under the age of 13, no internet-enabled phones. So we're thinking about things always in terms of restriction and banning these things. What that message sends is that this is not something that we should be talking about. And I've seen this particularly in the context of smartphones in schools. People will use the phrase, you know, we want it to be out of sight and out of mind so that they can focus on their studies. I absolutely agree with that. Yeah, you should be focusing on studies and developing social relationships at school. But that message that this is something that we don't talk about, I think is a really unhelpful one. And I'm probably a little bit of a hypocrite here because before I started writing Unlocked, you know, we all have bad habits and bad relationships with our tech, right? We're all trying to figure it out. And I do really distinctly remember a few times sort of at the start of writing the book where my daughter was about three then, or when this was happening, I think, that, you know, I'd be on my phone in the playroom and I didn't need to be because I was stressed out about work, because I'm always stressed out about work. And I was probably checking an email when I didn't need to be. And she'd look at me and she'd see me on my phone and she'd say, Daddy, what are you doing? And I'd go, whoop, nothing. Turn my phone off and put it in my pocket. Mm-hmm. That is the wrong message.
Oh, so fabulously attractive now.
Yeah. What message does that send? Mm-hmm. A, that this is something really interesting that mm-hmm. grabs our attention, that's maybe more interesting than me at the minute. Mm-hmm. And it's something that we don't talk about and we hide. It's very personal to ourselves. We don't share it with people. It's just the wrong behavior to model. And I try, you know, I still am on my phone sometimes when I shouldn't be because it's a really difficult habit to break. But what I try and do in those situations is turn it around and model a better outcome to that. So, you know, if she asks me what am I doing on my phone, I'll show her and I'll talk to her and I'll say things like, do you know what? I'm on my phone. I'm on my emails at the minute, and I don't want to be. I don't need to be. I'm just a bit stressed out because of this thing that's happening at work or whatever. And she's bored by that. She's not interested in all that sort of stuff. But it's not the content of what I'm saying. It's what I'm doing, which is talking about it and being open and saying that it's okay to talk about these things. And I don't think we do that enough. Broadly speaking,
I agree more. I do think, you know, we talk about literacy quite rightly all the time. I'm a huge advocate for other types of literacy. So emotional literacy, we can only learn it when we talk about it and do it every day embedded in the family. And exactly the same way with that digital literacy. You know, what you're describing there is an opportunity to say, oh, I'm drawn towards it. You know, I probably shouldn't. Here's what I'm going to do to resolve it. Here's how I'm going to repair that rupture, if you like. And it's so important. You're so generous, Pete, when you talk about these scenarios, because A, it brings it to life and other people will immediately relate. But, you know, you have the capacity to describe that experience and, you know, echo and illustrate so much in a little scenario, because you're teaching her the beginnings of digital literacy, and it can never start too soon. In exactly the same ways we learn our letters, in exactly the same ways we learn our moods, we're also learning about how to manage the digital world, because it's round us, so we better figure it out. So I think that's really great. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Thank you for saying that. The main lesson there is that we're all learning this, right? You know, that we've got a lot to learn. I've spoken a lot about the need to focus more perhaps on digital literacy and resiliency skills building than out and out bans. And I think I've been misunderstood by people sometimes, though. When I say that, when I say I don't think the evidence supports a ban in schools, for instance, it's not going to fix the things that you want it to fix. We need to be focusing more on building digital literacy skills from an early age. I think sometimes people read that as me saying it's fine to give kids from a very early age a phone and figure it out. And that's not what I'm saying at all. It's absolutely not. I'm very much in the camp of my daughter's five, she doesn't have a phone. I don't see the need for her to have a phone for quite some time. And I don't want her to have one until I think she's in a better place than I ever was in terms of being able to handle it. But those skills you can build from an early age without even using technology. It's little things like being open. I struggle with like talking about emotions and those sorts of things because I came from a family where you don't talk about those sorts of things. So it's taken me a very long time, and I'm still not there to be able to do that more comfortably. But being a father has really helped with that, because I can see those situations that I remember being in when I was young, that I know that I didn't get the response that I needed from my parents that would have helped. I can see what that is now. So I think just little things like saying, when my daughter's had a bad day at school, just saying, I'm here. If you want to talk about this, I'm always here. Even if it's something that you're worried that you've done wrong, I want to know. You're not going to be in trouble for telling me that ever. And I think that's really important in the tech space. We have some evidence that shows that when you create these sorts of situations, and I don't mean this in a guilt-tripping way. I think we all struggle with this. But when we inadvertently create these situations where we've actually got quite an authoritarian situation going on, no video games console in your bedroom because I say so, end of, or no phones in bedroom or whatever it is, they generate arguments, right? And those are the things that we're struggling with as parents, those pinch points, particularly in the evenings, around ending use or putting boundaries around use. When you do that in an authoritarian way, there was a great study a few years ago that asked like 1,000 UK teenagers, okay, here's a scenario where a parent's trying to enact a tech rule and they're being really authoritarian about it. How likely are you to stick to the rule? And they say not very. If you give them more what we call an autonomy supportive situation, and that's not being a permissive parent or anything like that, it's still putting in clear expectations, but you're co-creating that with them. You're saying, look, this is why I want you to not have a games console in your room. Why do you want one in there? Well, let's talk about that and let's see how you feel about doing this. And we are going to do this, but I want to get you on board with it, basically, and doing those sorts of things. And you ask kids, how likely are you to break the rules? And they still say they're going to break the rules, because that's what teenagers are. They're rule breaking machines, right? It's actually quite an important part of being a teenager.
Absolutely.
Pushing boundaries.
That's how you discover something new. If you don't do what you're told, you might discover something new. Yes.
The key difference is that in the authoritarian sort of condition, teenagers are much more likely to report that they're going to hide their tech use from their parents and caregivers. And that's the scenario that we need to avoid. That's where the risk lies, because you don't know what they're doing. You don't know how they're doing it. And when something goes wrong for them, they don't want to come to you, or they're reluctant to come to you, because it will involve disclosing a breaking of the rules. As a first thing. So it's not just something bad's happened to me that's really upset me or really harmed me, but I've gone against what you told me to do. So I know what you're going to say. You're going to say, I told you so, and it's going to create an argument. And that's the situation that you want to avoid. And again,
I love the way you say when something goes wrong, because it's so important. It's a bit like saying when somebody offers you alcohol, what are you going to do? It's not, so you're assuming that this will happen because mistakes happen. They will happen. You will see some content. You will do something that we haven't discussed. This is going to happen. So how are we going to deal with this? Looking at us together. It's a really important nuance in the way that you're using the language. It's fantastic. And actually one of the greatest compliments, I guess, as a parent that we could ever have, or indeed, mental health worker, a teacher, anybody supporting a young person, is that we get to be privy to a mistake. You know, if a young person says, this happened to me, you take that opportunity with both hands, because it's a chance to figure out what's going to happen and a chance to strengthen your relationship, because figuring that out by yourself is unlikely to be a good experience, and certainly not a learning experience.
It's really hard. It's really hard, though.
Yeah.
I had it with my daughter a few weeks ago, that she was really struggling to get to sleep, and she got really upset, and you know, went into her bedroom and was, you know, saying what was up, and she said, you know, I did something bad today, something went wrong. And in that, I could feel myself panicking in that moment, because I was like, oh my God, this is one of those moments where you can really screw it up if you say the wrong things. And you know, I can't remember what it was that she'd done, but she was really upset about it. I think she'd like hit another child or something, because she got frustrated. And she knows not to do that, and she knows that's not right. And me saying you've done something wrong, that's terrible, doesn't help. She already knows that. That's why she was upset. But trying to use moments like that have nothing to do with being on social media or being on the internet, but just to create a space where you go to them, you know, thank you for telling me, and I'm sorry that this happened. It sounds like you've had a really tough day. How do we figure out a different way of dealing with that situation for you when it comes along next time? Mm. It's those sorts of skills and opportunities that will help them in their online space. And I really feel that, so I should say, none of this, I'm not saying here that we shouldn't have rules or anything like that. Of course we should have rules. It's just how we kind of explain them and negotiate them, I think, is really important. I get this general sense in the public discussions around social media and smartphones and things like that, is that, you know, it's very heated. People feel as though there's a real urgency to do something now and to do something severe, because we've all been terrified. And there are some absolutely awful things that happen. Nobody is saying that they're not, and nobody is saying that there aren't real harms online. Nobody is saying in this space that the tech companies are, you know, they're fine. They absolutely need to be doing more. That's going to take time, and there are things that we can do in the meantime individually to make things better. But I really get this sense that because of all of this stuff, it's almost like we're trying to protect kids from everything. And that's where the ban comes from, right? You know, if they don't have a phone, then the bad things online aren't going to happen to them because they don't have a phone. And I find this a really uncomfortable thing to say, particularly as a parent. But I think we have to accept and face the reality that our job as parents and caregivers isn't to bubble wrap kids and protect them from every bad thing that ever happens, because they don't develop any resiliency if they do that. The world is a really tough place. There are horrible things out there. They are going to come across difficulties and things that they find uncomfortable and things that potentially harm them. What they need when they face those scenarios is the resiliency to weather them and the support networks to help them get through. Mm-hmm. I think you see that in the literature around digital technology, that, you know, that question of why do some children thrive online and others struggle, it's to do with things like the building blocks of the education, to know that when something bad does come their way, they know how to weather it, they know how to talk to people and talk it through, so that the harm is not as extreme as it could be and doesn't lead to further harm.
Well, the good relationship is the prism through the experience, you know, and it will either, it will go one trajectory or another. And the confidence to be able to come and say this happened, because one of the things is about the solitary nature, if you like, of some of the consumption. So as a young person, I need to proactively come and say this happened, or I'm not sure about that. And so there is a sort of, there's more momentum required for the young person rather than, let's say, you know, watching a shared experience of something that was potentially traumatic, because you're around the event and you can, you know, translate and dive in. But you're talking about the power of those relationships, and it's such an important point. I think we should turn and ask to our final now what question. And this is, I'm asking a lot of tough questions, but you've raised a lot of questions here that I think are very pertinent, because we know that involving young people in tech decisions, you've raised this already, is much more likely to increase their success. And whether that's a national policy or a family guideline, you've talked very clearly about the best ways to engage people. So what is your top tip for engaging young people, whether that's research or family guidelines?
It might sound like a really obvious, almost patronizing one, but it's talking to kids. That I've been in various fora where we've talked about the state of research with researchers from all around the world, and the most useful ones that I've been in are ones that have got youth representatives in there, and you ask them what they think and they come up with blindingly good ideas for doing research, really insightful comments, and their voice is not really being heard in the public debates at the minute. And when it is, I think it's happening in a very leading way as well. I think we always have to be careful about who's asking the questions of them, and how those questions are being constructed. And very often when the youth voice is being used, it's essentially as a soundbite to support somebody's point of view.
Yeah.
And I think that does them a tremendous disservice. I think, they have a lot invested in this. In this discussion, in this debate, digital technology is not going away. Mm. What we need to do is support them so that they use it, like I said earlier, use it better than we ever did, right? And nobody's quite sure what that looks like at the minute. That's okay, but we need to get better at figuring that out more quickly. Mm. So co-designing projects with them, co-designing rules and regulations with them, not just so that you hear their voice in those rules or whatever it is you're talking about, but then they've got buy-in, they've got a vested interest in those things working out, not just like asking them what sorts of research questions do they want to know the answers to, but bringing them into the research process. There are some studies that they're not quite off the ground yet. They are in their very early stages, but I'm really excited about, because what they're thinking about is how do we, one of the big struggles we've always got is we don't have data from the tech companies to answer a lot of these questions, so we rely on self-report. But there is something else that we can do, which is that we can ask people to donate their data. Mm-hmm. That's not easy. There are lots of kind of legal and privacy issues around that, but it's not impossible. And I think doing that as well, so thinking about engaging young people, thinking about what data they give out there to the world, what data they own, what data they can donate to research, and how they do that in a participatory way. I think there are lots of areas to explore around those sorts of questions that I think would be really useful.
We've got so much to do and so little time. I think we should bring our episode to an end, but I'm so delighted that we've had your expertise. Nuance and balance is what I hope for, and nuance and balance is what we got. So it just remains for me to thank you, Professor Etchells, for a wonderful episode. Many thanks indeed.
Thank you for having me.